Welcome to a new edition of the Neon Jazz Interview Series with veteran jazz pianist Joey Calderazzo. From his base in North Carolina, he talked about a wide range of things that are going on in his life today. Namely, a 16-month-old son, touring with Branford Marsalis quite a bit, along with creating music all the time. His story is raw, revealing, and very intriguing. Dig it, my friends.
Hey, thank you for taking a little time to talk with me. I appreciate it.
Sure.
I'm just going to go ahead and start right off the bat here and just ask you, as far as activity, what's been going on with you lately?
Trio touring, Branford Marsalis touring, got a 16-month-old baby boy, and, you know, just, and I'm teaching. I'm an adjunct at a school in North Carolina. The sum of all its parts, right?
Yeah, you got your hands full, that's for sure.
Yeah,
that's for
sure.
You were born in New Rochelle, New York.
What
was the jazz scene, or what was it about that community and your upbringing and your family that got you into an environment where you wanted to get into jazz and music?
Well, I was in a rock band, and I have a brother that's 4 years older than me that's a drummer. So I was in a rock band. Everybody was 4 years older than me, and our guitar player went to Berklee School of Music in Boston for a summer program and came back and was into jazz, and I got into jazz actually through him.
There was a note in your bio that there was a friend that lived next door at the age of 7 that got you into playing the piano.
Well, what had happened was I went over there every day, or I mostly went to his house. I mean, we were next door neighbors.
Yeah.
And every day, or, you know, whenever it was, a few times a week, his mother would make him practice the piano. Instead of going home, I would just sit there for 20 minutes and watch him. And I kind of liked it. I thought it was cool.
Yeah.
And I went home and asked my parents for piano lessons. And sure enough, they got me piano lessons, and that was it. And in hindsight, I guess it's pretty cool. I mean, how many 8-year-olds are asking for piano lessons?
Yeah.
So I clearly wanted it.
Yeah, that's cool. So as a kid, did you always want to grow up and be a musician, or did you have other dreams?
I never really thought about what I wanted to do. I was fascinated with the ocean. I remember at one point I wanted to be like an oceanographer. I wanted to be like a deep sea diver.
Yeah.
I was really fascinated with, you know, sharks and, you know, all of that. I had all these books. But around 14 or 15, I was like, I really enjoy playing music. And you know, from the time I was 17, I was working.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I worked at McDonald's for 5 days or 4 days, and I delivered, you know, I worked in a pharmacy in 1982, and I graduated high school in 83, and I never had so 1983, I'm like 17, 18, I never had a job.
Wow, that's great.
You know, I was playing in little clubs, making $75 a night or whatever it was, 50, doing jam sessions in New York and, you know, playing parties. And, I mean, that was it. And then I think in, like, 1984, I went on and worked on a cruise ship in Europe.
Oh, cool.
You know, made, like, $200 or $300 a week. And you know, it was my first time away. And then in 1987 at 22, I was in Mike Brecker's band, and I've been doing it since.
So at 14, you were in your brother Gene's band, and you were the youngest.
Well, no, I was younger. You know, so I'm in eighth grade, I guess, and they're seniors in high school.
So it's kind of like, what was that like to be around older musicians? Did that kind of get you more wanting to make that as a part of your life, or what was that experience like?
I mean, they were older than me, but I was as good as them. So it wasn't like, you know, hey kid, you better get it together. It was never that.
Yeah.
So, you know, and I was in eighth grade, and we were like an original band.
Yeah.
So I was writing, I mean, the songs we wrote were crap, but we were writing music.
Was it Oscar Peterson that maybe got you first really interested in jazz piano as far as, like, jazz musicians?
But yeah, so when the guitar player came back, then it was jazz, 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 and it was more fusion-oriented stuff. So it was Weather Report and I guess Herbie stuff and Miles Electric stuff and Return of Forever. And then I had this compilation of jazz tunes, and it was Oscar playing Take the A-Train, and I just remember being like, you know, wow, I really want to play like that.
Yeah.
And, you know, so after that summer program, a year later, my brother and that whole band went to Berkeley, and I used to go up and visit, and I would, you know, I would be in the practice rooms jamming with everybody and walking around and hanging out, you know, and then I would meet guys and they would tell me what to check out. So then from checking that stuff out, it was, you know, Coltrane's quartet and, you know, both Miles' quintets. So I quickly got into, you know, Herbie's acoustic playing, McCoy Tyner and Keith and Red Garland, Wynton Kelly, Bill Evans, and Thelonious Monk, and it's just been an ongoing steps, always going backwards. So I kind of bounced in and out of several different schools. I have zero college credits.
Okay. Well,
so it was, I kept going on the road, or I would, you know, lose interest. I just wanted to play.
Yeah.
And I had an interesting, you know, at 17, my dad died, so my life changed drastically.
Yeah.
You know, there's more to the story. I mean, it's 1982. My house burns down on April 22nd, and then July 3rd, my dad dies.
Oh, wow.
So it was, at 17, it was, you know, so we were, from May and, you know, from end of April until October, we were living in a rented house.
Wow.
And my dad dies in the interim, and then we moved back to the house, you know, without my dad.
Wow.
So it was, there was a lot of shit going on. It was deep. And that's sort of why it was, you know, my mom was dealing with her, you know, with, and then my mom's mom died the following February.
Wow.
So it was like, you know, to a certain degree, my mom was there, but I mean, we were all left to our own devices. It was like a what the fuck, you know? And so music was really an outlet, you know, unlike the kids today with camps and universities, I'm definitely the result of having good private teachers and learning all this shit on the road.
You know, it's interesting. Phil Woods, I talked to him at one point, and he went on and on about, it's fine that you go in the classroom, but the world's classroom is being out in the world, and that's where you're going to get it, touring and going, and it seems like that's where you got your education, in the world's club and classroom.
Well, everybody did back then. The level that the kids are at is much higher than it's ever been. And actually, there's an argument to be made, higher than some of the greatest musicians that ever lived.
Yeah.
But, you know, when you look at, you know, you look at what music really is, you know, the technical aspect is really just a part of it. You know, what made Coltrane and Miles and, you know, Wayne and Herbie and Art Tatum and Monk, it's the story being told. And, you know, I think, you know, the information on its own is sort of irrelevant and doesn't really, it tells only an aspect of the story.
I want to backtrack for a minute here and just ask you, going through that, it's such a formative age of your life to go through a rough time with your family. Do you think music really saved you, was really something that was kind of a lifeboat for you?
Music, my friends, you know, my friends were there. Just got through it, right?
Yeah.
But it's definitely one of those, you know, 19, out of all the 50 years I've been alive, 1982 is still, you know, the 82 and 87 are the biggest years of, you know, my life, right? It's, you know, they both, 82 and all that shit happened, and then 87 I met Mike.
Yeah. Well, speaking of Mike, what has Mike taught you about music and life?
Record. Yeah.
Yeah. What did he teach you about music and just being alive? What did he teach you?
Mike was, I think, 17 or 18 years older than me. So my dad died when I was 17. I was playing with Mike at 22. Mike looked after me. I mean, Mike became, my relationship with Mike was more of a father and son. I just adopted him and, you know, and there were, you know, and I cared what, you know, I cared about, you know, how what Michael perceived of what I was doing. And I was crazy, man. I mean, it was really a young 17-year-old running around. And when I met Mike, I was a young 22-year-old, you know, loved playing music, but I was crazy, you know, drinking and women and the whole thing. And it was a lot. At 50, I've grown into it.
So you played, you obviously have a very long standing relationship with Branford Marsalis. You played with Jerry Bergonzi. What has it been like to be with these people and to learn and grow and play music with them?
I mean, the neat thing about it was, at least my perception of it is, these groups that I'm in, the way I play and the music I write and the stuff I bring in and just the way I think about stuff has been accepted in both bands. And because of that, the sound of both of those bands were changed. You know, and the neat thing about it, it's, you know, so from 98 until 2005, I was playing in both bands.
Yeah.
Mike was playing my songs. I mean, I was more or less the musical director of Mike's quartet. Not that it needed one, but, you know, Mike would be like, what do you want to do? And I'd be like, let's do this, this, this. And he'd be like, yeah, all right, let's go. And, you know, and Branford's band is, the neat thing about Branford's band is anything I'm working on or anything I write, he'll play.
Yeah.
But if I come in and I was like, man, I'm working on this Duke Ellington tune and I can't really play it, can we, you know, he's like, sure, we'll play it tonight. So it's that thing. The downside of it is because I was so integrated in these bands and my role in these bands were part of what made them sound like they did. The idea of like putting out my own records and touring with my own group, I was sort of like, why?
Right.
You know, and here I am at this point now, you know, with a working group and trying to get out there, and there's still this perception of me being, you know, the side man of these two groups.
Right.
So I've, you know, it's tougher, right? You know, to be out in the marketplace. Plus, we live in different times. I mean, the times are really, really different. I mean, I'm a middle-aged jazz piano player.
Well, and that was a question that I had for you, too, kind of towards the top I was going to ask. You know, you were in New York City for a while. Why North Carolina right now?
Look, it reaches a point where, you know, it's sort of like, you know, maybe this is as good as it gets. I was with a girl that was a crazy relationship, and we needed a change. Branford was living in Durham. And I had an opportunity to, which I'm still doing, I've been doing since 2006, an adjunct professor at a local university down in Durham. So it was sort of like, you know what? And then the house I was living in Rye, New York, and the house I was renting was sold. So I'm 40 years old, and I'm thinking to myself, what am I going to do? And I just figured I would look and see what the rentals were like in North Carolina. And, I mean, I rented a frickin' mansion for, like, $2,000 a month or something like that.
Yeah.
I mean, it was amazing. And then I got down there, and it was, like, you know, trees, and it was nice. And I just said, you know what? The hell with it. I like to play golf. I mean, I'm an avid golfer, so, I mean, I was living on a golf course, and now I'm living. Branford and I are neighbors living in the same community, which is on a golf course. I think this is what you have to do. You know, plus I don't drink or get high or do anything anymore. You know, I'm settled. And the idea of like, I mean, I love going into New York and visiting now, but the idea of being there and, you know, and hustling for those $100 gigs, I mean, I don't want to do that shit anymore. You know, and then it's the aspect of, you know, you go there to meet people, but I'm 50 years old. I don't want to play with a 20-year-old. Yeah, I can't. I can't. I mean, you know, I played with Mike Brecker. I played with Branford Marcellus. I played with Bob Berg, Elvin Jones. I mean, I'm not supposed to do this. I'm not supposed to be playing, you know. I mean, it'd be one thing, because every now and then I think about it. I mean, if Kenny Garrett called me, I'd play with him. If Terrence Blanchard called, I'd play with him. But, yeah, you know, if I played with Christian McBride for a year, I would do some gigs with him. But I can't commit to touring in anybody's band anymore. And I see all these kids coming up doing it, and you know, that's what they're supposed to do.
So as a teacher, what do you try to teach your students?
It's really actually simple. I just, you know, to me, jazz is supposed to sound a certain way.
Yeah.
And once they understand what it's supposed to sound like, that's, we just keep working on that.
Yeah.
You know, we work on basics. You know, I have, you know, unlike the North, a lot of the kids at where I teach are just, they've never been exposed, you know, to the information, the scales, the chords, the songs. So we work on very basic things, and every now and then, you know, I get a student that I've been able to go a step further. And those and when they get to that level, it's just really sitting around talking.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. It's that's all it is.
Yeah.
Or I'll hear a kid play and I'll just say, you ever think about doing it like this? But I mean, we're on a very, very basic level with a lot of the students. And I mean, you know, that's like taking a song like All the Things You Are and outlining each chord, you know, by 1, 3, 5, 7. And then those are the scale degrees.
Yeah.
And then playing 3, 5, 7, 9 and going up to 13. So they understand, you know, if the first chord is F minor, that, you know, G is the 9th and D flat's the 11th and D is the 13th. So they understand that. And it's not like, you know, well, you know, what's the flat 13 of F7? And they're sitting there like, you know, so it becomes automatic.
Yeah.
And that's, because to me, where I grew up and I studied, I played with Dave Liebman, I studied with Joanne Burkeen, and I studied a whole bunch with Richie Byrack. You know, and this alphabet, especially I heard Dave Liebman talk about it, it's non-negotiable. You have to know it.
Right.
You have to know it. You know, Branford doesn't know it verbally, but he knows it.
Yeah.
He knows it. I mean, it is amazing to me today the amount of knowledge that this young group of musicians have.
Yeah.
You know, these young piano players. The majority of them, what they're, you know, and it's hard for me to listen objectively because I'm a piano player. So I listen to piano players and I'm like, holy shit, this kid has so much together. And then the more and more I listen, the more and more it seeps in is that, wow, he has all this information, but he has no story yet. You know, you look at guys like McCoy and Chick or Herbie. I mean, Herbie blows my mind when you listen to what Herbie plays on Four and More at the age of 24. It's deep. It's like, or you know, equate it to golf. You know, Jordan Spieth just won the Masters. He's 21 years old. Yeah. How the fuck does he get so good so fast?
That's right. That's right.
I mean, and it's really crazy at 50 years old now to look at this. Like, so I'm 50, and the music that I still study are guys that are half my age. You know, and that's Herbie and Chick and Monk and all of these guys. I'm still trying to figure out what they did. They were kids. In a weird thing, I'm 50 years old checking out kids. But those kids just happen to be Herbie and Chick and McCoy. And it's just really wild.
Well, it reminds me of, you know, Clark Terry took that young kid, Justin Coughlin, under his wings and said he was one of the greatest things he ever heard. And Clark's, what word do you use to describe how incredible he was? And he saw it in this young blind kid that just tore it up, man. He just went out there and he just had it. And I think that's, you know, it's nature versus nurture. And I'm sure now that you have a 16-month-old, that's what you look at. You think, God, is this something that is just kind of brought in with the goop of living, or is it the environment? You know, it's interesting. It's very interesting to think about.
You know, and it's an interesting thing to watch, like a 16-month-old. All we're really discussing now is learning process. What happened when I was 17, 18, 19, I could learn something and then instantly integrate it into my playing. Chick showed me something once, and we were playing a double bill at the Blue Note, and Chick was amazed that I actually just used it on the next show after he showed it to me. He was like, holy shit. But that's kind of gone.
Yeah.
It's gone. I mean, I'm working on, I started working on all of this Barry Harris stuff. You know, Barry Harris has this whole thing of, you know, with drop two voicings and playing it over a bebop scale. And it's, you know, it ends up being like a mind fuck because it's everything's moving. So you have four voices and they all move.
Yeah.
And back in the day when I was a kid, this is something I could have just played right off the bat. Oh, it's this, and then just did it.
Yeah.
But now it's like I'm slowed down. And that's just, you know, the mind is changing. It's definitely at least the learning process.
Let me ask you this. What's the greatest thing about waking up every day?
Waking up every day.
Yeah.
Now, honestly, it's, I was talking to Eric Rivas because he has two children. Times are tougher now. Tours are shorter. We don't get that run. I mean, look, my trio stuff, I started doing this. I always did trio gigs when I wasn't working, or quartet gigs. And now it's, you know, so in 2010, you know, I right out of the gate, I had good gigs.
Yeah.
And it's tougher. It's tougher now. And, you know, I put out this record and the record's getting rave reviews and all of this shit. But it's hard.
Yeah.
And, you know, and then the other thing that's hard about it is there's so many more musicians, and we'll just talk about piano players, and there's a ton of piano players.
Right.
And whether they're good or bad or average or whatever, it doesn't matter. But what's happened is, especially abroad, a lot of the European promoters look to see, you know, so you got kids that are on major record companies, so they're going to get the push because they're coming out of America and they're the new stars of the instrument. I'm not a new star.
Yeah.
You know, when I first hit the scene at 22, after Mike's first tour, man, every record company was calling me.
Yeah.
Every record, I could have chosen any company.
Yeah.
Chick Corea called me personally.
Yeah.
You know, he had Stretch Records, and I just signed with Blue Note. And I did my three records for Blue Note, got dropped, and, you know, and I don't have a lot of records out as a leader.
Yeah.
And I have three for Blue Note, one for Audio Quest, two on Marcellus Music, and one on Columbia. And then I've done these two, so it's like maybe nine?
Yeah.
In a 30-year career?
Yeah.
It's not a lot.
Yeah.
So now the plan is to put out a record every year and let people know that I'm actually really doing this. The end result of this is, and it's come with getting older and having a little more wisdom, is, man, fuck it. My dad died at 49. I'm 50. I'm not looking at, you know, I'm healthy and, I mean, I'm playing better than I've ever played.
Yeah.
Right now. Yeah. I mean, we played the other night in Mexico City. And, I actually wrote Chick Corea an email because I know he's out with Herbie and I know they're having fun and I wanted to go see them. And I played a Yamaha CFX, that's what Chick is playing, and I mean it was maybe the best I've ever played in public, and
cool.
we all got off the stage and we were like, man, that may have been like the best show we've ever done.
Wow.
And I mean, so think about the number of shows that I've been doing with Branford since 98.
Yeah.
It's a lot, and it was just one of those shows where the music was relaxed, but it did everything it was supposed to do. It was open. It was free. It was just incredible.
Yeah.
And every show, and then we played in Mississippi the other night, and it was a weird, it was a different audience.
Yeah.
So we actually just played standards. And it was the kind of thing like, you know, Branford's like, let's play this one. And I didn't know that I remembered it, and we just played it. And it was just, it's just taken on a new form,
yeah.
You know, and it's, you know, and then, so I have a family, I have this, and maybe, you know, it's not as much as it once was, or yeah, I just find myself like not caring. You know, I remember reading an interview of Martina Navratilova. Remember the old tennis player?
Oh yeah, oh yeah.
And you know, in the thick of it, and in her run, it was, she just felt like she never really enjoyed it. Because
yeah.
It was just always, and I'm enjoying it.
Yeah.
And I'm, you know, and I can relate to Chick and Herbie doing this duo tour, because
yeah.
It's, you know, Chick told me, he's like, we're having so much fun.
Yeah.
And that's what it's supposed to be.
I was going to ask you another question, but I think you summed up so many things with that answer. I think that might have been where I'd like to end this. Thank you. Continued success. And keep on keeping on, man.
All right, man. Talk to you soon.
Thanks for listening and tuning in to yet another Neon Jazz interview, where we give you a bit of insight into the finest players in New York City, Kansas City, and spots all over America giving fans all that jazz. And thanks to Joey for his passion, honesty, and always quality jazz. If you want to hear more interviews, go to Famous Interviews with Joe Dimino on the iTunes Store, or you can always visit theneonjazz.blogspot.com for all things Neon Jazz. Until next time, enjoy the music, my friends.
Neon Jazz.